hearing it from the mouth of someone in the Kremlin inner circle.
You say he's going to move on October 7th?
Give or take a day or two, yes,
Alex said.
His original plan was to attack on October 25, the anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Now he's pushing the generals to be ready sooner. And my father-in-law is not a man to whom one says no.
But I don't understand. This doesn't make sense. He's willing to risk nuclear war to seize three tiny states most people couldn't find on a map?
Perhaps most Americans cannot find them, said Alec. But I assure you that every Russian can.
You believe they're yours?
They are ours.
That's why you want them back.
Of course,
Alec said.
Then why are you here telling me this?
Why tip your hand? Why not let your father-in-law seize them in a surprise blitzkrieg?
The answer to that is very simple,
Alec said.
He is ready to risk nuclear war and the deaths of millions to get these three countries back. I am not.
60. The weight of that statement stunned Marcus into silence. Glancing at his watch, Alec continued.
Few people really know this man, Agent Riker. I do. I married his daughter. I became part of his family. But I had no idea what I was stepping into. My parents revered him. My Marina worshipped him. What reason did I have to think of him any less highly? But now, I have worked for him for years. I've traveled the world with him, been in most meetings with him, taken his dictation, handled his personal and professional correspondence, been sent on delicate diplomatic missions for him. I've spent more time with this man than with my own wife. And I'm telling you, I'm sickened by what I see. He uses people to gain whatever he wants. And then he destroys and discards them without another thought.
And what does he want?
Power, riches, glory, sexual pleasure, you name it. And not in moderation. His appetites are insatiable. When he has something, he craves more. When he does not have something, he will kill to get it and to stop others from getting it. He is a man without conscience and without remorse.
Another Stalin?
No. I don't see him like a Stalin or a Khrushchev. He's not like any Soviet-era leader. Yes, he was shaped by those times, but he was never truly a communist. He joined the party in order to advance his own ambitions, not the party's. When communism died, he discarded it and moved on.
A Hitler, then? Marcus asked. Ready to grab the Rhineland? Ready to show the Western powers that they didn't have the will to stop him? Ready to kill millions, tens of millions, when they finally did try to stop him?
Alec shook his head slowly.
No, he's not a fascist or a national socialist.
Then what?
He sees himself as a czar.
Meaning what?
Meaning he sees himself as a visionary, an imperialist. He's determined to regain and restore the glory of Mother Russia by any means necessary. He believes Russia was humiliated by the Western powers in the previous century.
And is that how you see him?
In part.
But?
I believe the best way to think of him is as the head of a crime family.
Like the Godfather? Marcus asked. You're saying he's Vito Corleone?
I'm saying he's Sonny,
Alec replied coldly.
Ambitious, but rash, reckless. And he has a nuclear arsenal and the willingness to use it.
Marcus stood and walked over to the window.
You do not believe me?
Alec asked. No, I do believe you, Marcus replied, closing the drapes completely, then checking the hallway through the peephole to make sure no one was standing outside his door. But I'm not sure who else will. He paced for a moment, then sat down again. If you're telling the truth, you're committing treason by talking to me, Marcus said, as much to himself as to Alec.
I am telling the truth, but I am not committing treason,
Alec retorted.
I am not betraying my country, Agent Riker. The president is. The whole reason I have come to you, the whole reason I am telling you this, is because I want to save my country.
How? Marcus asked.
You must tell Senator Dayton what I've told you, without telling him your source. The senator must then tell President Clark, and Clark must order his generals to send the necessary troops and tanks and planes to the Baltics to create a serious deterrent, a speed bump, as it were, large enough to cause my father-in-law to pause, to think twice, to back down before it's too late.
Why not just go to the U.S. Embassy or to the media?
Because then I'd be found out and murdered for certain.
And you think coming to me is safe?
Not safe, but perhaps safer.
Perhaps? Marcus asked.
Agent Riker, please listen to me. Ever since I first heard about this madness and saw the war plan, I've been trying to come up with a way to stop it. The only way I see is to get word to the White House of what is being planned. When the senator's request for a meeting came across my desk, I saw you were traveling with him. That's why I immediately recommended to my father-in-law that he take the meeting. It took some effort to persuade him, but in the end, he accepted my logic and agreed to receive the senator and his delegation. I did not do it to meet Mr. Dayton. I did it to meet you, because I realized you might be the one person to whom I could plead my case. Do you recall that time in Berlin when we first met?
Marcus nodded.
Do you remember what I called you?
No.
I called you a hero.
I'm not. I was just doing my job.
You were willing to take a bullet to protect your president, your country's government and way of life. And that wasn't the first time. I have read a great deal about you, Agent Riker. I know that when your country was attacked on 9/11, you volunteered to join the Marines. I know you served in Afghanistan and Iraq. I know you are a patriot. I suspect you have not agreed with every decision made by every leader you protected. But you defended their legitimate right to make even poor decisions, because they were chosen by the people and would be held accountable to the people. Well, I am no different, except that I don't have the luxury of living in a democracy. My leader is a thug, accountable to no one, and he is leading our nation, the country I was born in, the country I love, into disaster. I have come to you at great personal risk, because I believe you can understand this better than any politician, and I'm asking you to help me, Agent Riker, because time is short, and I don't know who else can.
The praise made Marcus uncomfortable, but he sensed it wasn't flattery. Perhaps it was really what Alec Kraskin believed. Then again, perhaps it was an effort to manipulate him. This could be a setup, another plot to deceive, maybe even masterminded by Luganov himself. But why would the Russian leader send his son-in-law here in the middle of the night to tip the Americans off to an invasion of three NATO countries? What advantage did that give the Kremlin? I can't take this story to the senator without proof, Marcus said. And the senator certainly isn't going to President Clark unless he has proof that an invasion is really coming. He would need evidence. Something concrete and compelling.
Don't worry, Alex said. I have all the proof you need, and more.
61. It was nearly 6 in the morning when Alec left. Marcus waited as long as he could, which was about 35 minutes. Then he called Nick Vannetti. He apologized for calling his friend so early, but Vannetti said he'd already been to the gym for an hour and was just about to head to the office.
It was great to see you last night, all of you guys, but especially you and Pete, Vannetti said. The ambassador found the whole conversation fascinating. He hasn't been invited to sit with Luganov since he arrived in the country. Don't tell him I said so, but I think he was a tad jealous.
Thanks, Nick. But this is not a personal call, Marcus said.
What's wrong?
Something's come up. I need to see you immediately.
Sure, no problem, Vannetti replied. My morning's full, but I've got time around 2. How about then?
No, Nick, it has to be now. Clear your schedule.
Why? What is it? What's wrong?
I can't say.
Even on a secure satellite phone?
No, it's too sensitive. Can I come over now? I wouldn't ask if it wasn't critical and time-sensitive.
All of you?
No, just me.
It's that serious?
Yeah.
All right. It's, what, 6:39 now? Can you get there by 7?
Yes.
Fine. I'll give your name to the Marines at the front gate.
Marcus hung up the phone and headed to the elevator. Along the way, he told 3 of his men he was going out for a bit, and if they needed anything, to talk to Pete. Hailing a cab, he directed the driver to Bolshoi Devyatinsky Periulok, number 8.
Ah, the embassy, the driver asked. You Amerikansky, da?
Da, Marcus said, handing him a wad of rubles. And there's a lot more if you can get me there by 7. The unshaven man didn't speak much English, but he understood enough. He hit the gas and raced through the streets of Moscow at high speeds. When he finally pulled up in front of the U.S. Embassy, they were late. It was 7:12, but Marcus gave him the big tip anyway, knowing full well he'd never have gotten there any faster on his own. He showed his passport to the Marines in the front guard station. They immediately cleared him through and passed him off to a young aide, who took Marcus straight to Nick's office.
What's wrong, Marcus? The deputy chief of mission asked when they were finally behind closed doors. You okay?
I don't know, Marcus said.
I think so.
So what is it?
Why all the secrecy and urgency?
This room is secure, right? Marcus asked, walking about the spacious corner office, covered with power photos of Vannetti with all kinds of high-ranking American officials, and a few Russian ones as well. I mean, it's not bugged, is it?
No, of course not.
You're sure? Marcus pressed.
Yeah, I'm sure. It was swept yesterday. Sit down, let me get you a cup of coffee, and then you can tell me what's got you on fire.
No, no coffee, I'm fine, Marcus said.
Well, I'm not, Nick said. I was up late with a couple of old buddies and a few too many beers. As I recall, you were there, too.
He walked over to his desk, pressed an intercom button, and asked his secretary to bring in a fresh pot of his favorite Brazilian blend and some blueberry muffins.
Right away, sir, came the reply.
Nick, I don't want a muffin. Too bad, I do. Now sit. Talk to me.
Marcus was pacing, but at Nick's insistence, he took a seat across from his old friend. Last night was great, he began, trying to figure what exactly to say and how. I mean, I completely disagree with the senator's analysis of the meeting with Luganov, but the time with the ambassador and you and your team was great. You put together a stellar evening with almost no notice, and I owe you one.
Thanks.
You got that right, and you're welcome. But something happened after we left.
Tell me.
Marcus paused and took a deep breath, then lowered his voice and looked Nick square in the eye. Someone came to see me in the middle of the night.
Who?
I can't say.
Can't or won't? Just hear me out.
Fine, but hurry it up. I don't have all day, even for you.
Marcus reached into his pocket, pulled out a black sapphire Samsung Galaxy phone, and handed it to Nick.
Thanks, buddy, but I have my own.
Turn it on, Marcus said. Nick looked down and turned the phone on. Now enter 6653 and the pound sign. Nick did. Open up the photo gallery. Again, Nick did as he was told, and found 53 photos. Nick looked at Marcus, then back at the phone. It took a moment as he scrolled through the photos, but Nick could read enough Russian to understand what he was looking at. Marcus saw the blood drain from his friend's face.
One of these documents is a Russian war plan to invade the Baltics, Nick said. And soon.
Marcus nodded.
And this one is an internal memorandum from inside the Kremlin.
Again, Marcus nodded.
Where did you get this, Marcus?
Luganov has a mole.
How high? How close?
I can't say.
Why not?
It's too soon. They're nervous.
They?
I don't want to say if it's a man or a woman, but it's a man.
I don't want to say. Just one person?
Yes.
And it's a man, Nick pressed. At least, tell me that much. Because if it's a woman that came to you in the middle of the night...
Fine, it was a man, Marcus confirmed.
And he obviously has access to classified information at the highest levels.
Marcus said nothing.
Is he a middleman?
Nick asked.
But did he get these himself?
He says he has direct access to these and more.
How much more?
Get out a pad and pen. Suddenly there was a light rap on the door, and in came Nick's secretary, a pleasant round woman in her late 50s, with a large pot of coffee, two U.S. Embassy Moscow mugs, a carafe of cream, a glass jar of brown sugar cubes, and two spoons.
Thanks, Maggie. That'll be all for now,
Nick said.
Hold my calls and all visitors until you hear otherwise. Oh, and one other thing.
Yes, sir?
I need Morris to come up here immediately.
Right away, sir,
she replied. Then left and shut the door behind her. Nick pulled a yellow legal pad out of a drawer in his desk. Marcus poured them both steaming mugs of freshly brewed coffee, even as he kept talking.
Luganov is running a highly sophisticated disinformation campaign to keep the U.S. and the rest of NATO confused about his real intentions. That's why he accepted Dayton's invitation, to tell him he's going to end the war games early and pull his forces off the borders when he's not.
He's planning to invade.
When exactly?
On or about October 7th, Marcus explained. But there's more.
I'm listening.
You heard last night that Luganov is about to fly to Pyongyang to make a major announcement, Marcus continued.
But it's all bogus.
Meaning what?
Meaning the treaty he's signing with North Korea, in which Pyongyang will publicly agree to give up all of their nuclear weapons in return for a formal defensive alliance with Moscow, is completely meaningless. There will be huge headlines in the next few days, and Luganov will win international acclaim for being a peacemaker, both on his western and eastern flanks. But according to my mole, Moscow will actually replace North Korea's flawed and somewhat unreliable nuclear weapons with far more powerful, accurate, and reliable Russian nuclear warheads and tactical nukes. See photo 39.
Nick did, and began shaking his head. The Russians have been working for the past 6 years on an electromagnetic pulse bomb to fry our entire electrical grid and send us back to the Stone Age, Marcus continued. According to the last document in the photos, the technology has been perfected, and the missiles are ready for launch. What's more, Luganov is fully prepared to detonate an EMP bomb over Chicago or somewhere in the Midwest if we fight him in the Baltics. But the mole and these documents say that the missile will be launched out of North Korea,
not Russia, seriously complicating our response.
Impossible, Nick protested. The North Koreans don't have an ICBM capable of reaching Seattle or L.A., much less Chicago.
Read to the end, Marcus replied. Apparently, they do. 62. There was another knock at the door. Marcus looked up to see a pretty, if somewhat studious, brunette with her hair pulled back in a bun, wearing a navy blue pinstriped suit that would have blended in unnoticed on Wall Street or at the Commerce Department, but was far more stylish than anything anyone else in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow was wearing. Nick was still poring over the photos, but as Marcus rose to shake the newcomer's hand, he said, "This is Jennifer Morris, CIA chief of station for Moscow. Not only does she need to hear what you're telling me, but she's fluent in Russian and can do a better job than I can at figuring out whether these documents are the real thing." Marcus was surprised. Morris couldn't have been much over 30. This was the ranking agency operative in Moscow? Nick quickly briefed Morris on all that Marcus had said. He handed her the Samsung Galaxy and asked Marcus to continue explaining what he'd been told by his source. Marcus waited a few beats for Morris to scroll through a dozen or so photographs, then picked up the narrative where he'd left off. "Obviously, I can't personally vouch for the authenticity of the documents in these photos," he conceded. "That's one of the reasons I'm bringing them to you. But if what the guy is telling me is true, they paint a pretty chilling picture." Morris worked her way through the documents, reading and studying each one carefully before moving on to the next.
"Luganov is ordering his generals to launch an all-out invasion of Estonia and Latvia, and he's projecting they can fully control both in under 60 hours?" she asked.
"Yes," Marcus said. "And they think it will take another 48 hours to seize Lithuania as well."
"The objective being what?" she asked,
still scrolling through the photos. "Divide and destroy NATO, then dictate terms to the West," Marcus said.
"Because we won't fight back?"
"Because we can't fight back."
"Why not?"
"The moment Luganov moves, the plan calls for him to formally and very publicly annex all three countries," Marcus said. "Then he will declare that any counterstrike by NATO or the U.S. will be considered a direct attack on the Russian Federation, and will lead him immediately and without question to order the use of tactical nuclear weapons."
"It's a bluff," Nick said.
"If so, it's a good one," Morris conceded.
"Do you believe him? That he'd really use nuclear weapons?" Nick asked. Morris didn't answer, but Marcus did.
"Yes, actually I do. But that's not the point."
"And what is?"
"My guy believes it," Marcus said. "That's why he came to me. He's terrified. He claims to know Luganov well, very well. He's worked with him for years. And he says Luganov wouldn't hesitate before ordering the generals to use nukes."
"This guy truly believes Luganov will start a nuclear apocalypse?" Nick asked. "I mean, come on. Luganov is a piece of work, I grant you that. But crazy enough to start an all-out nuclear conflagration? I don't buy it."
"Look, I'm only telling you what my source says. That's why he risked his life to come to me, to give us all this. So we'll pass it along to Clark in the Pentagon."
"So how close is he?" Morris asked.
"To Luganov, to the inner circle."
"Close enough that he got all of this," Marcus responded.
"How many people likely have code word clearance for documents like these?"
"I doubt more than 24, if that," said the station chief. "Can you get more?"
"I'm not sure."
"Did he give you a way to contact him?"
"He doesn't want me to contact him. Says it's too dangerous," Marcus said. "But I gave him my sat phone and a number where he can reach me 24/7.
"You gave him an official U.S. government phone?" Nick asked.
"It's not a government phone.
I rented some back in Washington for myself and each member of the security detail I recruited.
And your source, he agreed to call you?
No, but he took the phone and said he'd call me if he needed to. But I'm not so sure he will.
Why not? Didn't you ask for updates on the war planning?
Morris asked.
Of course. Did you tell him to call you if the date of the invasion was either confirmed or changed?
She pressed. Marcus leveled his gaze at her. Look, Miss Morris, I don't know you, and you don't know me. But surely Nick here has given you a thumbnail sketch of my background. I know how to interview a witness and handle an informant. I get the stakes here, and the time crunch, too. So you're just going to have to believe me when I tell you I got everything out of him that I could. I set up a way that the two of us could talk securely. What else was I supposed to do?
Is he willing to meet you again?
She asked. He said no.
Why not?
Because he doesn't want to be shot or hanged if he's found out. Besides, he said what he gave me ought to be more than enough to convince President Clark and the North Atlantic Council to start moving forces into the Baltics.
That's what he wants? NATO forces moving into the Baltics?
Absolutely. He must have repeated it at least 5 times. He said the only way he can see to stop Luganov from issuing the final invasion order is if there's a sufficient deterrent force in place, or at least inbound.
Morris was hurriedly making notes. So was Nick. The coffee was getting cold. Morris said,
So you gave him a phone, but you don't think he's going to call back, and he doesn't want to meet you again. Forgive me for saying so, but this guy doesn't exactly meet our usual standards for a reliable source.
Maybe not, Marcus said. But you gotta remember, this is a guy who took an enormous risk to reach out to me. It would be an even bigger risk to call or see me again. I don't think he's going to do it to give us more information, even if there's a change in the strike date.
I already told you, he believes he's given us everything we need to make a decision and get moving.
But I do think there's one thing that might make him call.
Morris leaned forward.
You think he'll ask for money? Because, believe me, if we can verify what he's telling us is true, the agency will give him whatever he wants.
No, he doesn't want money, Marcus said. He was emphatic about that.
Then what?
I think he might want us to get him out of the country before the dam breaks.
Did that come up in your meeting?
No, and that's been bothering me. I think he wanted to ask me, but hesitated.
Why?
Because he doesn't see himself as a traitor needing to flee his country, Marcus said. He sees himself as a patriot needing to serve her.
But you think he wants an escape hatch,
Morris said. Wouldn't you?
I would,
she agreed. Nick nodded.
So would I.
I think we need to come up with a plan to get him safely out of the country, Marcus continued. A plan that's ready to go at a moment's notice.
I think you're right, Nick said.
There's just one problem, Marcus said.
Just one?
Okay, more than one, but let's start here, Marcus explained.
If he does call, he's not going to want to work with anyone else, just me.
Why is that a problem?
Morris asked.
Because I'm supposed to fly with Senator Dayton and his team to Vilnius tonight, then on to Brussels and London, then back to D.C.
And if you don't leave, the Russians are going to notice, Morris said.
And get suspicious, Marcus agreed. And that's the last thing we need.
So you need to be on that Learjet when it takes off, Nick said.
Marcus nodded.
Right. But then, I'm going to have to get back into the country without the Russians knowing I've come back.
And how exactly do you propose we do that? Nick asked.
Marcus smiled for the first time.
Actually, I have an idea.
63. Marcus laid out his plan. It wasn't just critical that he be able to slip across the Russian border and get back to Moscow without getting caught.
There was another element he believed was vital to the success of the mission he was hatching. They had to get Senator Dayton back to Washington as quickly as possible. "There's no time for him to go to Vilnius," he told them. "Why not?" "My source was explicit. He was giving the information to me. I'm supposed to give it to Dayton, and the senator is supposed to give it to the president."
"But why Dayton? What does it matter who gives it to Clark?"
"This guy believes it will make a bigger impression on Clark coming from a critic of his," Marcus explained. "Plus, the president is more likely to order additional U.S. and NATO forces into the Baltics right away, if he has bipartisan support in Congress. That makes Dayton's support essential."
"Okay," Nick said. "So, what exactly are you asking me to do?"
"Find a way to convince Dayton to go back to D.C. and not Vilnius."
"And I suppose you have a plan to make that happen as well?"
"As a matter of fact, I do." By 9, Senator Dayton and Annie Stewart were back at the embassy. They had been summoned by Ambassador Tyler Reed, and now met in his 7th-floor office. Pete had not been invited, nor had Dayton's chief of staff or press secretary. Those three were back at the hotel, packing and grumbling about being left out of what everyone knew was an important meeting, given its last-minute and rushed nature. "Thank you both for coming on such short notice," Reed said as he huddled with Dayton and Annie, along with Nick Vannetti, Jennifer Morris, and Marcus. "Senator, I realize you're planning to fly to Vilnius in a few hours, but something's come up. It's potentially very serious, and I wanted to brief you on it and ask you to consider changing your plans." The ambassador turned the briefing over to Morris, who proceeded to give a summary of the war plan and other documents they had received, and how seriously the agency was taking a potentially imminent Russian invasion of the Baltics. The senator asked a flurry of questions. Morris gave as many details as she could, but said there were certain items she was simply not at liberty to discuss. Chief among them was the identity of the source of the documents, or how they had come to the agency's attention.
"What do you need from me?" Dayton asked.
"Well, sir, as you know, Washington is 7 hours behind Moscow,"
Morris noted.
"So at the White House it's only 2:37 in the morning. The president is asleep. But I can guarantee you no one at Langley, the NSA, or the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon is. Everyone is poring over these documents from every conceivable angle to determine whether they are authentic, and if they are, whether they truly represent the credible threat of an imminent Russian invasion of 3 NATO countries. Once that determination is made, the National Security Advisor will brief the president."
"But we need to warn the Baltic leaders," Dayton said. "I can do that myself, starting tonight with the Lithuanian Prime Minister."
"Actually, that's why I asked you to come back to the embassy," said the ambassador. "I need to ask you to leave that to the president and the secretary of state."
"But the prime minister is expecting me in Vilnius this evening," Dayton countered. "I've already had to reschedule once."
"I realize that, Senator, but please understand the sensitivity of the situation," Ambassador Reed replied. "We need to be careful not to rush to any final judgments. Our analysis is barely underway, but this has the potential of triggering war in Europe, and we need to keep the information tight until we're sure."
"It's not just the potential of war," Dayton noted. "We're talking nuclear war."
"Let's hope it doesn't get that far, but yes, we can't rule it out at the moment," Reed said. "And that's all the more reason to be careful of what we say and to whom we say it."
"You want me to hold back information about a potential nuclear conflict from our allies in the Baltics, less than 2 weeks out from a potential catastrophic invasion?"
"Correct. Until we know more, sharing this could inflame a situation that's already volatile enough. If and when we can confirm the documents and the threat are real, then rest assured that every NATO leader will be informed, the Baltic leaders, first among them. But for now, I need you to call the Lithuanian Prime Minister from my office. Brief him on your meeting with Luganov. Tell him what I told you. And tell him you don't buy a word of it. Then, head back to Washington immediately to give a personal briefing to President Clark on your meeting with Luganov.
Why?
Dayton asked. Isn't the president going to be briefed by his national security adviser? The ambassador turned to Nick Vanetti.
Sir, I've been on a secure call for the better part of the last hour with Bill McDermott, the deputy NSA, giving him the same briefing the ambassador just gave you. Bill assures me the White House wants a bipartisan response to this crisis, whichever way it unfolds. Having you there will be critical to gathering congressional support.
Marcus observed Senator Dayton as he processed the request. He wondered if he might pull Annie or himself aside to confer, but he did not. Instead, Dayton reluctantly, but professionally, accepted the ambassador's request and suggested they set up the call to Vilnius immediately. Marcus glanced at Nick and breathed a sigh of relief.
"Thank you, Senator," said Ambassador Reed. "America first, eh?" Dayton said. The ambassador smiled. "Not a phrase I would normally expect to hear from the lips of a progressive Democrat," he noted.
Dayton smiled back.
"No comment."
Reed continued.
"Normally, as you know, a U.S. senator wouldn't be in the loop regarding such a high-level mole at all. Certainly not one in the Kremlin on the eve of a possible war. But, given your leadership position and long years of service on the Intelligence Committee, you and Miss Stewart here are both cleared for all this. The rest of your staff is not. I trust you'll not share any of this with them."
"I'm fully aware of my oath, Mr. Ambassador, thank you. But what about Mr. Riker? Technically, he's not on my staff, nor is he a federal employee anymore. Yet he's been with us the entire time."
The ambassador, looking suddenly uncomfortable, glanced at Morris, and then at Nick Vanetti.
"You're absolutely right, Senator," Nick said. "But in this particular case, there's a simple explanation."
"And that is?"
"The mole came to him."
Part 7. 64. The Learjet was wheels up at 4:17 p.m. local time, and Marcus was on it. But the pilots did not head straight for Washington. Instead, they made a pit stop in Berlin, a mere 3-hour flight from Moscow. And there, Marcus said his goodbyes. Senator Dayton and Annie thanked him profusely. Pete gave him a quick hug and 2 slaps on the back, while Marcus whispered to him,
"Good luck with the girl."
Then Marcus shook hands with each member of the security detail, thanked them for a job well done, and asked if he could borrow one of their sat phones. Marcus never left the terminal. While he waited for the senator's plane to be refueled and take off for D.C., he rented a locker and stuffed his suitcase into it, along with his wallet and American passport. Well after nightfall, he linked up with a team of CIA officers dispatched by Morris, who led him to a Gulfstream business jet for the flight back to Moscow. The name Marcus Riker did not appear on the manifest, he knew. When the plane landed in Moscow, Marcus would not be getting off. He would be on the ground already. They crossed into Polish airspace almost immediately, then flew over Belarus and entered Russian airspace around 11:30 that evening. Marcus said nothing and talked to no one as he looked out the window at the lights of Smolensk, Yartsevo, Safonovo, and Vyazma in succession. When he felt the plane bank slightly to the north, Marcus checked his watch, waited 10 more minutes, then unbuckled his seatbelt, got up, walked over to the door, ripped it open, felt the blast of whipping winds and bone-chilling cold, and threw himself into the night air without saying goodbye. There was no hesitation. In the Marines, he'd done it hundreds of times. and it all came back quickly. Just after takeoff, the team from Langley had suited him up in a black military-grade jumpsuit and a black balaclava, Nomex flight gloves, an HGU-55P ballistic helmet, night vision goggles, a rucksack of clothes, a sidearm, water, a handful of protein bars, and a small first aid kit. Everything he might need to survive for the next 24 hours if his link-up were delayed for any reason. Now, as he hurtled toward the ground from 45,000 feet, Marcus could not see a thing. The frigid late September sky was thick with clouds, and there was no moon. There were no cities within 50 miles, no towns or hamlets or lights of any kind. Nor could he hear a sound, save the steady hiss of the oxygen flowing from the tank on his back, and his heart pounding wildly. If someone had told him 24 hours earlier he'd be jumping out of a plane anywhere in the world, he would have thought them mad. He'd certainly never imagined jumping into Russia, much less out of the side of a G-4. Yet now he felt an exhilaration that had eluded him for far too long. Marcus flashed back to the first time he'd ever jumped out of a plane. It had been summer. It had been a Cessna. It had been with Elena when they were only 17. They had done it without telling their parents and had even forged their parents' signatures on the permission forms, a move they both admitted had been wrong. Yet nothing the two of them had ever done to that point compared with the rush they'd felt that day. But Marcus didn't have time to think about his wife just then. He checked his altimeter. He was already below 4,000 feet. It was almost time. Seconds later, he passed below 3,000, then 2,000. Only then did he break through the clouds. Now he could see the clearing they'd chosen, and the edges of the forest all around it. The moment he did, he pulled the ripcord and felt the chute eject. The harness tightened under his armpits and groin. The problem was, he was still coming in hard in a densely wooded section of pines. If he didn't change course, he would likely be impaled on one of the trees, or get caught in the branches, and find himself stuck 4 or 5 stories above the ground. He did a series of S-turns, pivoting 180 degrees each time, then back again, nearly, but not quite, another 180 degrees, into the wind. This helped him correct his course and aim for the clearing. But it was going to be close. He could see the tops of the pines rushing toward him, and he prayed there might be time for 1 or 2 more turns. There was. When he cleared the edge of the forest, he was at 400 feet, then 300. Through the night vision goggles, he could see the ground rushing up at him. It was grassy, but also somewhat hillier than he'd expected. He made one more S-turn as he passed below 100 feet. Now he was headed for one of the flatter sections of the field. As he reached 15 feet, it was time to flare. Marcus pulled hard on the toggles above his head, both at the same time. He pulled them down to his waist, radically readjusting the shape of his canopy, and thus dramatically slowing his rate of descent. The maneuver worked like a charm, exactly like he'd been taught, exactly like he'd done so many times. An instant before touching down, he lifted his feet and literally hit the ground running. His jump master back at Paris Island would have been proud. Marcus came to a complete stop, pulled off his helmet, and shut off the oxygen tank on his back. Scanning the horizon in every direction and seeing no one, he quickly gathered up his chute and stuffed it back into the pack. Then he powered up the sat phone and sent a text to Nick Vinetti, consisting simply of the letter X. A moment later came the reply, the letter Y. Satisfied, Marcus stripped off the Nomex flight suit and redressed in gray slacks, a black crewneck sweater, Rockport work shoes, and a black leather jacket he'd stuffed into the rucksack he'd strapped to his chest. 15 minutes later, a midnight blue Mercedes SUV pulled to the edge of the clearing and killed its lights. Marcus chambered around in his automatic pistol, waited a moment, then approached the car cautiously. It was a formality, of course. If the driver or its occupants were FSB and had seen his highly illegal descent, he'd probably be dead already. When the driver's side door opened, it wasn't an FSB agent who stepped out. It was Jenny Morris, bundled up in a navy peacoat and beige scarf. And she had news. 65. Western Russia, 150 miles from the Belarusian border, September 26th.
Luganov's plane took off 2 hours ago, Morris said as she drove.
Heading east? Marcus asked, as he sipped the coffee she'd brought him in a travel mug.
Heading east, Pyongyang.
Check, he said, nearly burning his tongue, and deciding to wait until the coffee cooled a bit. What else have you got?
Quite a bit, she said. NSA has intercepts of communications between various Russian base commanders and logistics officers, giving orders that match almost precisely some of the written notes the Raven provided.
The Raven?
That's the code name the agency gave your mole.
Randomly generated?
Not exactly,
Morris conceded.
When I sent back the eyes-only cable to the director with my write-up of your report, I gave your guy that moniker. Guess it stuck.
So, why the Raven?
Does it matter?
She asked. Don't we have like a 2.5-hour drive to the safe house?
Yeah.
Then I guess we have plenty of time, Agent Morris, don't we? After bouncing around over some rocky terrain, they turned onto a real road, and the ride smoothed out. Morris glanced at him and smiled.
I guess we do, she said. But call me Jenny, okay?
Jenny, got it. So, why the Raven?
It's a biblical reference, actually, she said. But don't tell anyone at Langley. They probably think it has something to do with Edgar Allan Poe.
What's the biblical connection? Marcus asked.
The Old Testament tells a story about this prophet named Elijah. He was on the run from a wicked king, she explained.
Ahab, Marcus said. Morris seemed surprised.
Exactly. Elijah had no food, no water, but God provided for him, led him to a small brook on the east side of the Jordan.
And then commanded the ravens to bring him bread and meat each morning and evening, Marcus added.
That's right, she said. I guess you know the story.
I do, Marcus said.
My grandmother taught it to me when I was a little girl,
Morris said, as she blew down the desolate country road at more than 80 miles per hour.
She used to say, Jenny, God always knows what we need, and if we'll just trust him, he'll provide from the most unlikely of sources.
Like a raven, said Marcus.
Like a raven,
she agreed. Later, as they drove east toward Moscow on the M9 highway, Marcus asked where she was from.
I'm afraid that's classified, Mr. Riker,
she smiled. Call me Marcus, okay?
Okay, but it's still classified.
So you could tell me.
But then I'd have to kill you,
she finished. I'm afraid you'll have to get in line. They laughed. Marcus knew it was agency protocol for field agents, and certainly station chiefs, not to reveal personal details. He thought it was probable that Jenny Morris wasn't even her real name. But whoever she was, and wherever she'd grown up, Marcus now knew she had a grandmother who taught her the scriptures when she was little, and she'd liked those Bible stories. She'd remembered those stories. And all these years later, she was drawing on those stories in a time of great danger. It was almost 3 a.m. when the Mercedes SUV pulled to a stop. The rain had started nearly an hour ago. Thunder rumbled overhead, and jagged sticks of lightning stabbed the moonless night sky. Marcus wiped the fog from his window and tried to get his bearings. To one side of the street, he saw a giant crater where an apartment building once stood. Morris pointed to the other side of the street.
That's us, she said. 9th floor, apartment 9D. Grab your stuff and meet me in the lobby. I'll pick you up, but I need to park in a garage around the corner.
I'll go with you, Marcus said.
No, you go inside and stay dry. I'll just be a minute.
There was no point arguing with the woman. She had the same air of authority Marcus remembered from some of the other CIA agents he'd worked with in the service. So he opened the passenger door, grabbed his rucksack and parachute pack from the back, and dashed inside. As he did, he noticed the number on the side of the building, 20 Gurianova Street, and in an instant, he knew where he was. From inside the dry lobby, he looked back at the crater and closed his eyes. He could envision the massive explosion emanating from the basement. He could see the 9-story building teetering at first, then collapsing so quickly that no one could have possibly gotten out in time, especially those who had been sleeping, which would have been nearly everyone. He had studied the case years before, during a Secret Service training class in Beltsville, Maryland. One of his instructors had spent an entire day discussing the series of apartment bombings in Moscow and around Russia that had occurred in the fall of 1999. They'd studied crime scene photographs. They'd read forensic reports translated from Russian. They'd watched interviews with key participants, and even a frontline documentary on the bombings that had run on PBS. At first, Marcus hadn't seen the crimes as relevant to his protection duties. But the instructor had argued that anyone doing advance work for the president, the VP, or a foreign leader had to consider every possible method of assassination, no matter how bizarre, no matter how unlikely. Sure, a would-be assassin might use poison, or a sniper rifle, or a suicide vest to take out his subject, if he, or she, could get close enough to the target. But might not the same sick mind choose to kill hundreds or thousands of people in a high-rise apartment building or an office building in order to take out their target? "Ladies and gentlemen," the instructor had stressed over and over again, "you'll never play effective defense unless you truly understand how to play offense. The only way to properly guard your protectee is to think like an assassin. Until you do that, until you get into the mind of evil and see the world through the eyes of a killer, you'll never know how to counter all possible moves." The apartment bombings had never been solved, Marcus recalled, and apparently at least one of the buildings had never been rebuilt, the one directly across this very street. Russian authorities had blamed the attacks on Chechen terrorists, but Marcus's instructor was unconvinced. "Look at the evidence," he'd said. "The bombs were made with military-grade explosives, available only to the government. We know that not only from analysis of the bombs that exploded, but also from the unexploded ordnance found by police in an apartment building in Ryazan." Marcus remembered asking his instructor who else could have done it. In the fall of 1999, it had certainly seemed like the Chechens were to blame. Every Russian was already horrified by the atrocities going on in Chechnya. But looking back, the instructor had asked a simple but profound question. Who benefited from the bombings? Certainly not the Chechens. Grozny was carpet bombed that very month. There was, however, someone who did benefit. Who was it who had stepped into the spotlight in the wake of the apartment bombings? Who went on TV to very publicly order the Russian invasion of Chechnya? Who saw his name ID soar and his approval ratings with it? Who but Alexander Luganov, the Russian Prime Minister and former head of the FSB? A man who not only had access to the explosives used in the bombings, but also clearly benefited in the aftermath. Lo and behold, once Luganov had ordered the bombing of Chechen cities, the apartment bombings suddenly stopped. Luganov was elected president of Russia soon after. Was it really possible, Marcus had wondered so long ago, that Luganov had ordered some of his loyalists to blow up Russian apartment buildings so that innocent Russians would die and he could blame it on the Chechens, order retaliation against Chechnya, and see his approval ratings soar into the stratosphere so he could be elected the new Tsar of Russia? It had all seemed rather far-fetched at the time. Yet what would the people of eastern Georgia say now? Or those who lived in Crimea or eastern Ukraine, or Syria. 5 minutes later, they reached the ninth floor. Jenny Morris unlocked the door to the three-bedroom apartment and hung her soaking wet coat in a shower stall. Marcus tossed his stuff in one of the bedrooms and headed back out into the hallway.
"Where are you going?"
Morris asked as she dried her hair with a towel. "The basement," he said. "I just want to check things out. Make sure no one has left a present for us. Don't worry, I won't be long." 66. CIA Safe House, Moscow, September 26th. Morris let him sleep for 4 hours, but that was it. There was work to be done. She told Marcus to join her at the kitchen table. Then she explained that she was going to administer a polygraph test and record the lengthy and critical conversation they were about to have. He was not happy, but she did not care. "You know the stakes," she said, matter-of-factly, "and you know the drill. So let's get this done." Marcus didn't work for the government. He wasn't on the federal payroll anymore. They couldn't tell him what to do. But neither did he have anything to hide. He knew the polygraph test was the agency's way of verifying that the information he had provided was genuine, and that he didn't have any ulterior motives. So, although he wasn't thrilled about the prospect, he shrugged and allowed her to continue. Morris attached several sensors to Marcus's body that would track his heart rate, blood pressure, breathing rate, and temperature, and feed the data to a laptop. She started with a few control questions, designed to establish a benchmark of his honesty.
"Is your name Marcus Johannes Riker?"
"Yes."
"Do you currently live in Washington, D.C.?"
"Yes."
"Are you presently in the city of Moscow?"
"Yes." She carefully watched the lines on the display showing data from the sensors. She had told Marcus to look straight ahead, not at her or the laptop's display. But he glanced over and saw that the lines were all flat. Next, she asked Marcus to answer several questions untruthfully in order to see if the sensors would properly pick up the minute but distinct changes in his physiology, indicating his body's unique response to lying. Once she was satisfied the machine was functioning as it should, and that Marcus was cooperating appropriately, Morris moved on.
"Did this source take the initiative to make contact with you?"
"Yes."
"He reached out to you first?"
"Yes."
"You weren't the one to initiate contact?"
"No."
"Did you meet the source in your room at the Hotel Nacional?"
"Yes."
"Did the source provide you with pictures of classified documents, purportedly from the Kremlin?"
"Yes."
"Did you look at all 53 of the photos on the phone?"
"Yes."
"Are the documents authentic?"
"I can't say."
"Please keep your answers to yes or no," Morris instructed. "Do the documents look authentic to you?"
"Yes."
"Did the source tell you he believes President Luganov is preparing to invade a NATO country?"
"Yes. Well, no. Actually, 3 NATO countries."
"Just yes or no, please,"
Morris reminded him.
"Is President Luganov preparing to invade 3 NATO countries?"
"Yes."
"Did you believe your source?"
Marcus paused. He wasn't sure how to answer that. Morris tried again.
"Did the source seem credible to you?"
"Yes."
"Do you believe he was sent to set a trap for the U.S. or NATO?"
"No."
"Do you believe anyone in the Russian government directed the source to reach out to you?"
Marcus paused again. It was a good question. He wasn't entirely sure. But he said, "No." On the display, the lines jiggled. Morris looked up sharply and asked the question again. Marcus again answered no. And this time, the line stayed quiet.
"So you believe the source reached out to you of his own free will?"
she continued. "Yes."
"When the source left your presence, did you immediately contact the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy?"
"Yes."
"Did you give the Samsung phone containing the photos to Mr. Vanetti?"
"Yes."
Did you show the phone or its contents to anyone else prior to meeting with Mr. Vannetti?
No.
Did you inform anyone else prior to contacting Mr. Vannetti about the phone